Alan Kring Productions presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 2 for Autumn Semester 2018. Lecture 4, delivered on August 30, 2018. The title of this lecture is Types of Markets.
Today, Types of Markets. Really difficult because when I say markets, there are so many different market dimensions. For example, I could say a money market versus a capital market. A money market is a market for short-term funds. A capital market is a market for long-term funds. So we got a money market here. You, sir, need $100, and you come to me, your favorite professor, a prophecy. Can I bum $100 for a week from you? And, of course, I'm going to say, are you on crack? No. No, it depends on what you need it for. I mean, you know, if you're going to die within, like, 10 minutes if you don't have it, I'll see what I can do to get to the bank in the next day or so to get it to you. That's a money market. Anything 1 year or less is a money market. Now, those are actually very active, huge, insanely large markets. These vast oceans of liquidity that are flowing through the world at any given time. And that liquidity, we're talking about flows of liquidity that can be on the scale of a year, 6 months, a month, 30 days, they can be on the scale of a few hours. Have any of you ever gone, you were so desperate for money, you went to payday loans for a loan? No, you're not quite there yet. You wait, you will be. And at payday loans, that is a, you're, essentially the way those work, one way that they work is, okay, I'm going to get a, I don't have a paycheck for 2 weeks. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to say, okay, I need, let's say, $200. So they'll say, okay, all you do is you write us a check for $200. Oh, but and you're about to say, sounds good. And you, okay, wait. You've got to pay interest, obviously. And we're going to jack up your interest rate. We're going to charge 19.99% per year. So right off the bat, what's going to happen is they're going to say, okay, you got to write the check. Let me pull a calculator up here. So for 2 weeks... at $200 times 19.99% divided by 26, because it's 2 weeks, that would be 26 periods. So it's per week, it would be divided by 52. For 2 weeks, it would be divided by 26. $1.54. Well, that's not bad. For 2 weeks of money, all I have to do is pay $1.54. Okay. Okay, we're not bad. That's not bad. Okay, $200. Did I do that right? I guess I did. Yeah, that's a bargain. Oh, that's darn good. Oh, wait. You have a processing fee. Oh, well, what's the processing fee? Oh, that's $25. And then we have, of course, have to do the credit check. That's another $10. So, okay, 4, 5, 1, 6, 6, 3. Okay, so I'm going to write my check for $236.54. And this money will come from a money market because it's very short-term funds. Well, let's kind of look at what that actually means in terms of yield. Now, annualized yield, and I'm just sneaking this in on you right now, and I'll formalize it. We turn it into a yearly percentage. Everything we do, we want to have in annual form. Annualized yield is always going to be the ending value over the beginning value to the 1 over the number of years minus 1. One over the number of years. That's how you always annualize anything. End over begin to the 1 over the number of years. Well, how many years are there in 14 days? That's actually, now watch this done. If you want to do a photograph of this, this screen, I'll show you. You can do it with Google. Type in days between as a search, and you can do it. But this calculator, that's the plain old Windows calculator that's been there so long, you do a date calculation, okay? Now, all you have to do is say how many days, let's say from 30th, what would 14 days be? 31, 1, would that be the 13th? Okay. How did you do that? I can't do that in my head. Anyway, okay, so that would be to September the 13th. Really doesn't. Yeah, that's good. You're good. Okay, so that's 14 days. So that's, well, I wouldn't even have to have done that. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to go back and I'm going to say, go back to a regular scientific calculator. I'm going to say 14 days divided by 365.25. Always use 365.25 in your calculations for years, because there is that little hanging piece that we correct every 4 years with a leap year. So in other words, the number of years is 0.03833. About that. So in this case, the calculation would be the ending value, 236, what was that, 54, over $200 that you're getting now, to the 1 over 0.03833. Now, please be careful, in this class especially, rounding is dangerous to begin with. And when you're rounding on an exponent, the rounding error turns into a beast on you. That's why you saw me save that thing in the calculator, because then I'm not rounding it. Because, I mean, anytime you take an exponent that's rounded, you're going to magnify the rounding error. So watch how I do this. Okay, so I'm going to take, open parentheses, the ending value, 236. 54 divided by 200, close the parentheses, raise that y to the x, and then I'm going to open parentheses 1 divided by memory recall. You see how that saves me having to write down the number? And just always try to use a save memory to do this. Close the parenthesis, minus 1 equals now. We times that by 100 to make a percentage. Holy, do you see what's that number? That's a percentage. That's your APR on that payday loan. You do appreciate that that is insane. That is a 7th, almost an 8,000%
loan, annual APR. That's what that is. Now, there was a time in history when they took bankers who charged those interest rates and they hanged them and burned them, and then they punished them severely. Now, you can do this. Interestingly, there was a court case some years back, actually quite a few years back, where there are laws against this. They're called anti-usury laws. There are laws against interest rates that are too high. And it went clear to the Supreme Court, if I recall. And the Supreme Court, lawyers do not make good financial people. They are not trained that way. Their minds don't work that way. The Supreme Court just completely dismissed it. No, that's not against the law. The interest rate is 19.99%. The rest of those are just fees. Those aren't interest. Those are fees. And it was just thrown out. So you don't understand that those fees are part of the interest. And it's never been challenged since then, and it probably wouldn't work if it were challenged again ever, because poor people who get nailed with this and working class people, so it's never going to get to the Supreme Court again. So these interest rates are there, these insanely high short-term interest rates for people. Go. Exactly. Well, it's not a little higher. That's why it's so insanely high.
I understand
the fees, but I'm saying that wouldn't interest probably would come out on those fees, or for the sake of this, which I'm doing? No, they actually would, because the calculation of interest should always be on the total amount that you have to pay. At the end of this, the accumulation is going to be not on the $200, it's going to be on the entire $236, because that's what you owe at the end. So the interest that we have to do that in finance. We can't set aside, well, we're not going to look at that as part of the yield on the security. In the same way that when you borrow money on a home loan, the trick that is often played, especially if you do a refinancing, is what they call points. They stack a certain little bit of percentage. Say I want to refinance a loan, interest rates have gone down. They say, well, we'll let you do it, but we're going to charge you some points. So in other words, when they charge you the fees to do the refi, they're going to add some money to how much you borrow on the refi. That increases the interest rate on the refinancing right there. So that the APR no longer actually, you don't get to go from 6 to 4%. You are actually, those points cause the final interest rate to be more than 4%, sometimes as high as 4.5%. And that's their way of catching you so that you're trying to get a deal. You're trying to bring your interest rate down from 6 to 4%. They're not going to let you do that without paying a little bit of blood to play the game. That's just how it works. And it's very common in home loans. And that was one of the stunts that was played so much with them. Mortgages was that when you got a second loan, a third mortgage on your house, you were stacking points. Every time you got that new loan, they made points on it so that you were actually paying higher and higher interest rates every time you borrowed again on the house. Now, I'm going to tell you a little bit more about money markets. They kind of get ignored, but they are hugely important. For example, in the money market, traditionally, this has gone on for many, many decades. Actually, for more than a century, it's been a common practice. I'll give you an example. My eldest brother, who is now dead, been dead for a long time, he owned a boat store where people could go and buy motorboats, really nice ones or just regular fishing boats, but he had them all. Every year, early in the spring, he would have to put boats onto the showroom floor, just like a car dealer has to put cars on the showroom floor, just like a furniture store has to put furniture on the showroom floor. And then people walk in and they look around, they see something they like, and they buy it. Well, that means that every year, this the salesman, or rather the owner of the store, in this case my brother, would have to go to a bank and say, I need the floor plan loan. That's money that the bank fronts, lends to the dealer, so that the dealer can buy the inventory to put on the showroom floor. And then and also borrow enough money to pay the employees, because he's not going to have any money to pay them up front until sales start coming in. So he borrows enough for the floor plan and for his sales. And then as the year goes along, he can then pay down the loan until at the end of this season, the seasonal cycle, he's finished and he's ready, he's paid off the loan. And he's ready to do it again the next year. This is very common. I, as a businessman, as an artist, my show season goes from late spring through the early fall. That means that I have to be prepared to go to those shows in the winter. So what I do is I borrow the money, I go to my credit limit max, and I build my inventory, new art, new frames, maybe some new structural stuff if I'm getting something's breaking. And then as the season goes along, I make my sales and I pay down my balance. This is called working capital management. It's a huge part of any company that is in retail, working capital management. Now, my cycle is not the same, and the boat show guy, my brother, they're not normal. Their cycle is not normal. What would be the typical, almost all of your sales for a year come in a certain three-month period? Do you have any idea what that three-month period would be for many retailers? You don't? What?
Tax season?
No. Oh, God, no. You don't pay your taxes. God, what are you? What? Oh, yeah, Black Friday, right? Actually, we begin in October. I mean, we're pushing Christmas to September. Get Santa up after Labor Day and all that kind of stuff, for God's sake. Now, some countries are actually banning it. Canada won't allow you to start selling your Christmas stuff until after, November or something. But, yeah, our many, many companies, retailers, they're... most of their sales are going to be in that area from late October, November, December. That's just the reality of it. The rest of the year, you starve for sales. So what you're doing is you set up with a bank a working capital management plan. We're going to be borrowing money as we need to meet payroll through the year, as we need to build inventory through the year. We're just going to borrow money from you, and they'll say, okay, we're going to extend $500,000 to you. And then you run your show through, and then once the sales starts picking up, and you'll begin to see them start to edge upward in October, and then you market the hell out of Black Friday. I mean, you say this is the blackest Friday it ever has been. The sun is in eclipse. You know, the birds are flying away because it's Black Friday. And you sell like hell, as we used to say. And then you finally get to the point where you pay off those loans, that money that you were accumulating. And then as long as you do it, okay, you get to do it again the next year. And you do this every year, over and over. And a number of you are going to work in a business where this is just part of the business, that borrowing money through the year until you get that golden time when the sales start going up, and then you can start paying off those loans and going to the next year. That's just the reality of how we work. Those are money markets. And it's an enormous, not just in the United States, but all over the world. I mean, the money markets, and in some countries where we are trying to develop the consumer class, get them into consumerism, one of the critical aspects that we have to pay attention to is creating a banking system that is capable of doing this for retailers.
Not ignoring the fact that the retailers are going to be the ones who sell the products that get the people all excited about buying more products that allow us to hire more employees. And that's critical, that flow of money. I'll tell you another one about money. This is one that's, it's just amazing how huge this is. Many, many years ago, this was something that was only for the very rich and the very huge corporations. And when I was teaching finance in my early years, I would have taught this as for a more advanced class. Well, you know, this is something that you probably wouldn't see in your lifetimes until you get to be a rich person or you're in a very powerful corporation. And then I did some work out in Dayton, Ohio, and I ran into an insurance agent out there. He owned his own insurance agency, sort of an independent. Larry was his name. And we were just talking one day. He was sending his finance lady to the bank with the checks for the day. You know, people come in, they pay their insurance premiums, or they get them in the mail. She was packing those up and getting them to the bank before the bank closed. And he said, I've got to get these to the bank before the sweep. And I was just taken aback. I said, Larry, did you just say sweep? He said, yeah. I said, are you kidding me? Your little agency, your bank lets you do sweeps? And he said, well, yeah. And that was the first time I had any idea that banks had already begun to offer the sweep to you, to their employees. In fact, sweeps are going on all the time that you don't know about, but if you are well enough versed in them, you can participate in the sweep and profit from it. Here's how a sweep works. You, madam, are a retailer, and at the end of your day, you close up the shop, and you go to the bank, and you put your money in the bank. Now, you're going to go back to the bank to get money back out for the cash register and all that, and you want your money available to you, but that won't be until you open your doors at 8 o'clock the next morning, okay? So there from 5 o'clock until 5 o'clock p.m. until 8 o'clock a.m. the next morning, you don't need your money. So, but there is a hungry, hungry world that needs your money. And their business day is not clocking like yours. Their business day might end an hour earlier or an hour later, 2 hours, 5 hours, 12 hours later than yours. So what happens is that your money goes in to this vast pool of all of these companies on earth that do this through their banks. Their banks sweep their money out. Hour by hour, money is pumping in to this global liquidity. And this, I'm talking about not just millions, hundreds of millions, not billions, hundreds of billions of dollars is constantly flowing in. But then, of course, at about 8 o'clock, you're going to need that money coming back out into your account, but there's other money coming in at the same time. So at any given time, this is like a bladder that is having money pushing into it on one end and flowing out at the other, but it's a vast, huge well of money in the system that provides liquidity for currency traders, for borrowers, overnight borrowers, for banks that need money to meet reserve requirements overnight. It is just flowing in and then flowing back out. At any given time, this liquidity, again, is in the many, many billions. And I've seen some numbers that are almost in the trillions anymore. That's a sweep. So what about you? Well, you're earning a little interest in there. On the back end, when it comes back out, it's got a little money with it because you participated in investments, in extremely short-term money market investments. That's a sweep. And unfortunately, banks can actually do this without your knowledge. And they just keep the money for themselves. And then, they charge you fees or they give you tiny, tiny interest. But the reality is that the sweeps, you put enough money into this and you're doing very well. There is a dirty trick that is played by some American businesses. It's especially true in gasoline retail markets. There are some gasoline retailers. Well, you don't have to come inside. Just put your credit card or your debit card in at the pump and we'll pump your gas. Well, here's how that game works. I found this out the hard way. You're going to get gas, okay? So the typical car for a fill-up might be $40 to $50. They're going to take out, they're going to lock $100. And then you get your gasoline. Let's say that you get $40. So that's $60. You don't get that back right away. You get that back in 5 days or 3 days. They hold it. They play, they do what's called play the float. So at any given time, if you are a little gas station enterprise that's across America, maybe 1,000 stores, at any given time, you would have perhaps 10,000 customers locked in that you are playing their money. And when you give one customer back, there's another one who's come in and you've locked his money. So at any given time, you have an account with $600,000 in it continuously. And all it's just because, well, we have to do this because we've got to make sure that you can pay the price of the gasoline you bought. Well, bro, you took that out right away. That's instantaneous. Don't give me this crap of what you're doing. It's legal to do this, although it is entirely, you're having money, your liquidity is being used by another by a company to earn interest on that money right there. It's how a lot of it's how a number of companies do not immediately release excess funds when they lock them. They just hold them for anywhere from a day to a week, depending upon the type of company. So you keep an eye on your debit card balance or your credit card. You might notice that there is actually money that is should be available. For some reason, it's not available. I found this out when they locked out, and I had no money to buy food that night, and I didn't understand why. It was because they were playing this float at a gasoline station called Murphy. That's right, Murphy Oil, I'm naming you. Now try to sue me. Assholes. Okay. Another one. Another short term. Many very large credit-worthy companies. There's a story behind this. It's a huge, huge market. It's for what is called commercial paper. Commercial paper is very short-term borrowings by credit-worthy corporations, by huge credit-worthy corporations. You see, sir, you might not think you're going to live very long. Maybe another week, 2 weeks. At the outside, okay, a month or so, one way or the other, and that might not be why, but you are a short-term investor. There are some investors who have very large amounts of money, but they don't want to put it, invest it somewhere where it's going to be locked away from them. Or if they get it back, they'd have to pay a lot to get it back. You're a short-term investor, but you have lots of money. And there are a lot of companies that are like this. And there are a lot of huge corporations that need short-term money. So this is a market. This is an enormous market. They write commercial paper. These corporations, it's like automatic. They work through banks to do this. It's essentially like an IOU for, let's say, $5 million and the commercial paper 30 days, and you get back $5 million, and this isn't exactly how it works, $5 million to...
$5,002,000. You buy this paper from the company, and it gives you back a little more than you lent them 30 days later. Or it can work like a discount. It can work like this. The commercial paper, the company's going to pay you back $5 million, and you lend them, let's say, $4,996,000. So that would be discount paper. The company will pay you $5 million in 30 days if you will lend them $4,996 today. That's called discount paper. That's the way a lot of paper works. Treasury bills work that way, too. Okay. This is a huge market, an enormous market. It's very safe, or at least we think it is, but sometimes we get shocked. A real famous story about this was a company called Enron. Have any of you ever heard of Enron? Sort of the evil company of the universe. I mean, they were the scammers of all scammers. I mean, they were just lying through their teeth, and the big dogs in the company were feeding their money, the profits of the company, cash flow. They were just putting it into offshore accounts they'd set up in the Dutch Antilles and places like that, in the Seychelles. It was just an amazing scam they were running. And they were evil on a lot of levels. They were doing things. As a matter of fact, one of my fellow PhD students from Ohio State was one of their energy traders. Now, he was involved, and he was involved in another scam that Enron was playing, where they were selling electricity into California, but then rerouting it back out into Nevada to sell it to Nevada, and then sometimes they'd reroute it back into California and sell it to them again. Now, that takes cajones. And there was all this scandal at the time. There are brownouts and blackouts in L.A. See how bad our energy situation is in this country. No, it was Enron. They were selling. I think there was one where they actually rerouted it and sold the same electrons four times. Which is actually pretty darn entrepreneurial of them. And my fellow student, good friend of mine too, he was the one who was doing it. He was in a nice office in Columbus, Ohio, and he was the energy trader that was setting up the clicks and the switches to flip the electricity back out and back in and bill the states and their state energy companies for it. Awesome stuff. He spent a few years in prison, but what they didn't know was that he had one of those accounts offshore that they never found. He always did do better than I. Okay. That's money. One last little description of money. Now, you would have been about 10 years old when we were 2 hours away from the end of the world. Yeah, we were about 2 hours away from an apocalypse of the financial markets of the world that would have changed the entire course of civilization. Sort of a known story in finance, but it's not known to people outside of finance. Now, in the summer, late spring, early summer, of 2008, I and some other writers were sounding like crazies. We were saying there's something going to happen really, really bad. And I called for a break in the market. I posted my article in June of 2008. Something bad. It's going to break. I'm not sure when, within the next 3 to 6 months. And there were others, and we were laughed at. We were called crazies and all that. On the morning of September 15th, 2008, at 8 o'clock, the Federal Reserve System, especially in Washington, the analysts and the market watchers were seeing something very strange happening. There were billions of dollars being withdrawn from the money markets, in other words, from those short-term accounts. These were huge withdrawals, and they were happening at banks all over the East Coast at 8 o'clock. And I'm not, this is billions of dollars. And that's liquidity. Banks need liquidity. They need to be able to give you your ATM stuff, to honor your checking accounts and all that. And they were being drained rapidly at an insane rate. There was a, they alerted the Board of Governors, the top dogs, the seven heads of the Federal Reserve. Something really, really bad is happening. At about, the Board of Governors met in the around, I think it was like 9:30, something like that. They met by telephone saying what's going on. By 10 o'clock, this amount of money had been withdrawn from the money markets. That's staggering. That is at that rate. And by that time, the sun had come up at the on the East Coast and then in the Midwest, and we were going to have the mountain, and then the Pacific hadn't opened up yet. But as the sun rose across the world, this liquidity that was being drained would have a domino effect. And it was severe. At this point, liquidity had been drained sufficiently from the East Coast banks that they were going to need guarantees right away, within minutes, that there would be liquidity provided to them by the Federal Reserve in case they had cash runs from other cash runs. At 10 a.m., they shut down the withdrawals. They simply did, they said, banks, you will no longer honor any more withdrawals from money market accounts anywhere in the country. And the rest of the world followed suit. If that had not been done by noon, the entire United States financial system would have buckled because there would have been no liquidity. Essentially, you have drained all the oil out of an engine that was running at full tilt. And you would have had the United States banking system collapse, and as the sun clocked around the world over to Asia, their banking system would have collapsed across the world. Now there's a question, who was doing this? We don't know. Where did the money go? Well, when money goes out of one place, it has to go somewhere else. So we should have seen a price rise in something, gold. Stocks, bonds, something should have gone up in price. Nothing did. The money just wasn't there. And then there was an emergency session held of Congress, and the crisis was clear. They closed the doors, locked them, and at that time, interestingly enough, one member of the Federal Reserve Chairman at the time, the head of the Treasury at the time, Hank Paulson, Federal Reserve, was Ben Bernanke. They went to Congress and they explained, this is what's going on. And actually, the doors were locked, and there was one congressman who asked the chairwoman of the House, the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, Jeff Sessions, said, ma'am, are we under martial law in here? She didn't answer him. But there you go. You were 2 hours, 2 hours. That would have been it. Your ATM cards wouldn't have worked. Your checks would have bounced. Your paycheck would have not been there anymore, your savings accounts, your CDs, they would have all been gone, like that. So it was a close call. Let's not do that again, okay? But that was the beginning of that. Why? That was the start of why we had such an awesome, it's called the Great Recession, and it's called that for a reason, because it was the worst recession since the Great Depression. So that gives you an idea of what was going, of how fragile the system was at the time. Now, is it still fragile? Yeah, but that's your problem, not mine. I'll be dead by the time it gets to be an issue. Look, money markets. Now, capital markets are the big dogs where you borrow long-term for projects. You are going to buy a home, okay, a house trailer, and it'll be a double wide. Don't worry, it's going to be nice. We'll even throw in some velvet Elvis paintings for the walls and all that. Right? Yeah, okay. Life's good. So, but you're borrowing 15, 20, 30 years. That's a capital market. You are accessing the capital markets for that money. you want to put away money for your retirement. It's into a pension plan, it's going. That is money that is being supplied to a capital market. The government issues treasury bills. That is a money market because it's a one-year loan to the government. If the treasury issues a note or a bond, that's a capital market. They're accessing the world's capital markets. Ma'am, do you have life insurance? You do? Okay. That money is going into you pay in your premiums? That is what the insurance company puts into a capital market. Because they're not going to need it for you. I mean, you'll die someday, but not for a long time. So your family's not going to need that money. Or not going to be able to get that money unless they take some radical steps that I'm sure your family would never take to get the money from a life insurance policy from you. But that will be 30, 40, 50. That's scary because I used to say 50 years, but with you people, most of you will live to almost 100. You won't enjoy it, I guarantee you, but for like 80 years, possibly. So that's money that is being supplied to capital markets. Now, the odd thing is that you are both demanders and suppliers into these money and capital markets. You demand money from the capital markets, especially, but you also are a supplier to those capital markets. And that's that whole thing about financial intermediation. Financial intermediation. Financial intermediation is matching suppliers of funds with demanders of funds. Financial intermediation is matching suppliers of funds with demanders of funds. Taking into account Three factors. Factor one, timing. Well, let's do the first one. Level. How much? Yeah, you could say amount, okay? Look, madam, you need $5,000. You come to me, well, I can lend you money, but I've got like $20. I have more, but you know, like Chick-fil-A, I've got to buy some tonight. So I would be willing to, but it's just that you need more than I, or actually, you might want to borrow only $20, and I've got a large amount of money. I can't just lend out $20 to 1,000 people. I need to do it in one lump. So there has to be that amount matching between them. The next one is the timing. And I already mentioned this one, the timing. Now, some investors want their money to be put away for a long time. You would not want your money back for, let's say, 10 years. You would not want your money back for 30 years. You're going to look at retirement. You don't want your money back. Well, you'll retire. Judging from how it's going now, they'll let you retire at about 80 years old. So it's okay, though. You know, Walmart's not that bad to work at. The greeters there, yeah, they are bad. Yeah, I mean, I walked into Walmart. You know, you get the old guy, yeah, welcome to Walmart, go to hell. And, you know, or you're walking along and you hear a voice underneath you, you know, welcome to Walmart. And, oh, God, they're hiring midgets for greeters. I got to stop doing things like that. I've gotten in so much trouble. The one time the midget came in and kicked me in the shins. There were two of them. It was supposed to be a stage thing, but it was two little neighbor girls, and one of them did a high kick, and oh, change that lecture's tone. I was driving my car. I didn't see the stoplight, so I hit this car in front of me. These seven
dwarves came running out of the car. One runs up to me and says, "I'm not happy." And I said, "I know you're not. You're grumpy." And that's when the fight started. You can't beat seven of them at once. Risk! It might be that you are risk averse. You would lend your money, but only to a large creditworthy corporation. You might be a risk preferring person. You might lend your money to a new startup enterprise. So it all depends upon the type of risk that you want to take. So financial intermediation is matching these. Now understand that there are different ways that intermediation can happen. It can be entirely informal. You came to me for money. I said no, but I was grateful that you asked. It can be highly informal. And as a matter of fact, there's actually a very large informal market out there. That would be a direct kind of transfer or matching. Then there are a couple of indirect ways. There's a highly structured, formal way that it's done for things like IPOs, initial public offerings, or other kinds of public offerings. These are called investment banks. So I could do the direct. Private placements are oftentimes direct, or they're close to direct. Now, I was working with a group of rainmakers. It wasn't technically direct because they were actually representing money behind them, but they had money of their own. So in that time in my life, I was a direct intermediator. I was participating. I didn't have any money, but the people I was working with had large amounts of money that they could provide to companies directly, the people I worked with were the front of it. Behind them were the people who had the money, oftentimes families that had large amounts of money from places south of here to get into good places. Russians, the oligarchs, are direct investors. They move money straight into enterprises where the people are desperate and they're willing to sell their souls, and the money is there, large amounts. And it's obviously, when we're doing that kind of stuff, you've got to watch yourself, because a lot of times you ever gone to a restaurant, one of those fancy, weird restaurants that's kind of like, has very different food? Okay, here's something you don't ask. What is this?
Sure.
Okay, no, seriously. I was at a restaurant in Miami. They served a kind of sushi. It was moving. Bro, there was a jumping salad. Those shrimp were moving that salad. And that sea urchin, the weirdest thing was that the sea urchin lives. They just pull part of it out and they throw it back in and it grows new. I mean, God bless America and cheeseburgers. Wow. Or the eggs that in China, they boil the eggs 2 days before the bird hatches. You don't want to open that egg. Direct, dangerous. Those kinds of people, they generally have some reason why they want to move money in, and they don't want it to go through official channels. Just be careful if you're ever going to get into that world. That's no place for beginners to start. Now, indirect. There are a couple of different avenues. It's through others. Now, there are the simple, like, banks, and there are so many different kinds of banks. There's commercial banks. They do all kinds of commercial stuff, commercial loans. They do banking for other banks. I mean, those are real high, fancy ones. And then there are other kinds of financial services, other, like, credit unions and, I mean, mutual banks. And just there's just this whole world of different kinds of banks. And then there are banks that aren't really banks. But then on the other side, there are these animals called investment banks. Now, it used to be that investment banks could not be normal banks, too. It was called a Chinese wall, and it was under a law that was passed after the collapse of the economy that caused the Great Depression. A new Congress, a new president was brought in, and they just cracked down on all the crap that had been going on, the lies and all that kind of stuff, the scams, and they put up a wall. A bank cannot be an investment bank. Investment banks, essentially, you want to raise money by selling stock, you come to me, an investment banker. I'll buy, if you meet my qualifications, I'll buy your stock. You're done. And then me and my syndicate of other investment banks will sell it for our own accounts. That's really great when you can do that. You're done with it as soon as the offering goes live, as soon as the SEC says go. So you're out of the picture at that point. That's an investment bank. It used to be that there was a prohibition on these and these being the same banks. Because you see the problem here? A bank that takes your deposits, we don't want that bank to have the incentive to use one of the stock that it has bought, use your money for an underwriting that it has done. That's a conflict of interest. Well, Glass-Steagall ended in 1999. And so your bank can do whatever the hell it wants with your money now. And that should worry you, because we stopped doing that because of the insane crisis in the late 1920s. We saw it building through the 20s. We screamed bloody murder. You got to stop doing this. And they kept squawking about free markets and free enterprise. And you can't stop the job makers, the job creators from doing their thing that makes jobs. And now we ended up ended up having a communist country because people were so angry. And then on the other side, we had a bunch of fascists trotting around saying Heil Hitler. Somehow we managed to survive it without going crazy as a nation. But I'm not so sure that's going to happen the next time, because we believe people who cry to us about prohibiting free enterprise in that regard. That's another thing. Now, one last way that I want to divide up markets is when we're talking about capital markets for businesses. You have the stock market and you have the bond market. The stock market is where companies sell ownership in their company. The bond market is where companies borrow money for their companies. The bond market. We always hear about the stock market. I show you the stock market. In fact, the reason I don't show you the bond market is because it's pretty hard to find a good listing for the bond market anymore. It used to be maybe 10, 15 years ago, I could pull up a bond market listing and indexes for bonds. Can't do it very well easily anymore. The stock market is sexy. Prices go up and down and up and down. You can tell stories about companies and make guesses about, well, the stock market went up today because... The bond market is totally boring. It is 10 times the size of the stock market. 10 times the size of the stock market. But it doesn't whip up and down. It just floats along like this. It just drifts. It has very small movements. And there's a reason. A bond pays you at the end $1,000. You lend a company, let's say, money of 30 years at 8% coupon. For 30 years, you're going to get an $80 check in the mail because it's a $1,000 denomination is how it works. 8% of the face value, $1,000. And then for the rest of 30 years, you get $80. And at the end, you get one last $80 check and you get your $1,000 back that you lent them. That's how a bond works. And so it's got an anchor on it. So it's not going to whip and fly around and all of that kind of stuff. You ever gone on one of those insane rides at an amusement park? Well, imagine one of those that's like a roller coaster. It's attached. No matter how scary it gets, it's attached to the rails. But suppose that the rails go away. Well, then you get this phenomenon called yeehaw. You know, when you're on a YouTube video, your last seconds of life, you're saying, oh, God. And you're no longer anchored to something. That's stocks. They don't have an anchor. Bonds, no matter how wild the market can get, they're attached to that $1,000 at the end. So they are going to be safer. Their betas, in general, are going to be lower, much lower than the betas of stocks. And so the stock market is crazy. The equity market is wild. The bond market is tame. The bond market is much larger, much safer. And so a lot of investors preferring safer fixed income investments are going to walk to the bond market. Go. Did you have a question? Okay. That's the nice thing about the bonds. The bad thing is that they are lower risk, so you are not going to get that expected return that you get from the higher risk securities. That's just the reality of it. And so, in other words, insurance companies tend to put their money into bond markets. All those life insurance companies, those property and casualty companies, they will put money, a lot, huge, billions and billions of dollars into the bond markets because they don't want to take high risks. And in a lot of cases, they also want to put them into long-term bonds because they don't want the money back for a long time. There are bonds out there. You can imagine bonds that are 200, 300 years in duration, in maturity. Who in the world would invest in a bond that wouldn't pay off for that long? Any idea? Oh, families, you know, if you want to leave legacy. But I mean, with me, even if I was rich, I know my family's genes are going to be swept out. We're stupid. I shouldn't say that. We're down to a few members now. Think about this. Do you know we are right on a fault line here? Well, yeah, it's called the New Madrid. The last time it broke was almost 200 years ago. Matter of fact, almost exactly 200 years ago. The break was so violent that it threw the water of the Mississippi back north, and then it came back down like a tsunami. It wiped out. It was like reading the stories, the letters. It was like an apocalypse. Burning, killing, and it kept doing it. Not aftershocks, actual full earthquakes, one after the other. We're getting due for one, but they don't happen except every 200, 300 years. Keep that in mind when you go to bed tonight. That's all I have for you. I thank you.